He was born in a small Jamaican town, rose to become the most powerful black man on earth, and built a movement that stretched across five continents before being silenced by governments, betrayed by allies, and erased from history books. His name was Marcus Mosiah Garvey. He dreamed of ships, nations, and a unified Africa long before the world was ready. And though they tried to bury his voice, his fire only spread. This is not just a story about one man. It's a story of pride, exile, revolution, and the legacy that refuses to die. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Marcus Mosiah Garvey, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, Return of a Firestarter. 1914, Jamaica, the island that birthed him, the people he must awaken. The steamer rocked gently as it docked at Kingston Harbor, a plume of black smoke curling into the Caribbean sky like a whisper of distant battles still to come. Marcus Mosiah Garvey stood at the bow, shoulders squared, lips pressed in quiet determination. He had been gone 2 years, but the time stretched longer in his bones. He had left as a seeker. He returned as something far more dangerous, a man on a mission. As he stepped back onto Jamaican soil, the air smelled different, thicker, familiar. But now, familiar didn't mean comforting. It meant urgent. Every face he passed, every barefoot child playing in the dust, every washerwoman bending by the roadside, they were all pieces of a people who had been told, generation after generation, that they were less than. Their posture had been altered by centuries of subjugation, their aspirations limited not by nature, but by the echoing lies of empire. Garvey had seen their twins across the globe, black workers crushed in banana republics, black families erased from records in Panama, black sailors loading ships in the shadows of European ports. And now, he had returned to where it had all started. But he was not here to rest. He was here to build an army, not of soldiers, but of minds. Not of bullets, but of belief. The birth of the UNIA. It happened quietly. On August 1, 1914, in a small room at 76 King Street, Kingston, a space filled more with heat and hope than with furniture, Marcus Garvey founded what would become the most significant global black organization in history, the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. The name was deliberate, sweeping. It was not the Jamaican Association. It was not limited by geography or colonial borders. It was for the universal Negro, the Jamaican peasant, the Harlem intellectual, the Lagos merchant, the Trinidadian dockworker, the African farmer, the South Carolina teacher. All were part of the same fragmented body, and the UNIA was the stitching thread. The room was modest, a wooden table, a chalkboard, a few chairs. But Garvey stood at the center of it like a conductor before a symphony not yet born. He spoke of Africa, not as a land of savages, as British textbooks had long taught, but as the cradle of civilization, now plundered and bleeding. He spoke of self-reliance, not the kind that begged for inclusion, but the kind that built its own tables. And he spoke of pride, not arrogance, but dignity, a reclamation of what the world had tried to beat out of every black soul for centuries. "We will lift ourselves," he told them, "not by asking, but by doing. We will not crawl into the master's house. We will build our own." It was bold. It was radical. And in Jamaica, it was also deeply uncomfortable. Resistance at home. Garvey had expected resistance. He had not expected silence. For most Jamaicans in 1914, his ideas sounded too big, too fast, too impossible. The British Empire was not just their ruler. It was their reference point for success, civility, and structure. The average Jamaican had been taught to equate whiteness with order and progress, and blackness with chaos and backwardness. This indoctrination had taken root so deeply that Garvey's words, though stirring, were met with weary skepticism. "Africa? We are Jamaicans, not Africans. You speak like a man who forgets his place. Why stir up trouble when we are just beginning to eat?" The educated class scoffed at him. The political elite ignored him. The colonial authorities kept a wary eye on him, unsure if he was simply a noisy dreamer or something more dangerous. But the working poor, the field hands, the porters, the domestic workers, they listened. They came not in droves, but in trickles. And Garvey welcomed each one like a spark to a growing flame, building the foundation. Garvey worked relentlessly. Every morning, he rose before the sun, his shirts still damp from the previous day's sweat. He printed leaflets by hand, walked miles to deliver speeches in small church halls, engaged in endless debates in street corners and back alleys. He rented meeting halls on borrowed credit and hosted lectures attended by as few as three people. But he never wavered. He taught literacy classes. He organized reading groups. He began publishing a small pamphlet, early drafts of what would eventually become the Negro World, his global newspaper. He wrote essays, manifestos, poems. In each, the message was consistent. You are not what they say you are. You are not cursed. You are not forgotten. You are the descendants of kings and queens. And it's time to remember. At night, he lay in bed with blistered feet and a burning mind, replaying speeches in his head, refining arguments, planning the next move. He kept a notebook on his bedside table, half journal, half strategy guide. In it, he sketched logos for the UNIA, outlined a potential constitution, and jotted names of people who showed leadership potential. To the world, he was just one man. To himself, he was laying the foundation of an empire. The world at war, the race in peril. As Garvey was laying ideological bricks in Kingston, the rest of the world was beginning to burn. In Europe, World War I had erupted, an inferno of nationalism and greed that sent millions of men into the trenches. The British Crown called upon its colonies for support, and tens of thousands of black men, Jamaicans, Barbadians, Nigerians, South Africans, were drafted or volunteered, believing that fighting for the empire might earn them respect or a voice in the post-war world. Garvey watched this with sorrow and rage. He knew what would come. Black blood spilled for white empires. Black loyalty repaid with betrayal. He began writing even more furiously. He denounced the hypocrisy of colonial governments that demanded sacrifice but denied citizenship. He warned that the black race was being used, not honored. And he predicted, accurately, that once the war ended, black people would return home not to freedom, but to the same chains wrapped in different flags. And so his message intensified. The UNIA was no longer just a cultural organization. It was becoming a defense mechanism, a shield, a tool of psychological warfare against systems designed to erase. He began speaking not only of dignity, but of nationhood. He dreamed aloud of a free Africa, governed by her own people. He envisioned a global commerce network run by black entrepreneurs, schools that taught African history as proudly as any European curriculum, and perhaps most radically, a fleet of ships built by and for black people that would trade, travel, and one day carry them home. This was not nostalgia. This was revolution. The spark ignites. By late 1914, despite the early resistance, Garvey's flame had begun to catch. He was invited to speak at community halls with larger audiences. Farmers sent him letters asking for literature. Parents brought their children to hear him speak. And most importantly, young men and women began joining the UNIA, volunteering to spread the word. He organized parades, small at first, then growing in number, with banners proclaiming Africa for the Africans. He coordinated food drives and job support programs. He launched vocational training sessions, and still he wrote, always writing, pamphlets, speeches, vision statements, words that pierced through silence like thunder. The island could no longer hold him, but as the movement grew, so did the walls around it. Garvey knew that Jamaica, while sacred, was limited. Its economy was weak, its people divided, its colonial government hostile, and its reach too small for the global mission he now felt pounding in his chest. If the dream of black liberation was to survive, he needed more than island soil. He needed a platform loud enough to reach the world. He needed a city ablaze with black life, where ideas spread like fire and people moved like waves. He needed Harlem. A final walk before departure. One night, before booking his passage to America, Garvey walked alone through the streets of Kingston. The lamplight flickered on shuttered shop windows. Dogs barked in the distance. Somewhere, a woman sang softly, her voice cracked but beautiful. He passed by a chapel and paused. This was the land of his birth. This was where his fire had first been lit. But now, he carried that fire with him, and he would carry it across oceans. Not to beg, but to build. Chapter 6, A Dream Too Big for an Island. 1915 to 1916, the island's silence, the city's roar. The dream had outgrown the soil. The heat of Kingston still clung to Garvey's collar as he paced the floor of the rented meeting hall on King Street. It was mid-morning. The ceiling fan spun above him with a rhythmic groan, stirring hot air that carried the scent of ink, dust, and distant sea salt. Papers were scattered across the table, drafts of speeches, early membership forms, slogans scribbled in thick pencil. On the wall, a single sheet bore the words in Garvey's unmistakable handwriting. One God, one aim, one destiny. The Universal Negro Improvement Association had been born less than a year earlier. Its goals were sweeping. The upliftment of the black race, the redemption of Africa, the restoration of dignity. But despite Garvey's tireless labor, despite the energy he poured into every syllable, the island did not roar in response. It whispered, politely, cautiously. The people believed in him, but only in fragments. They came to meetings, yes. They listened, some even joined. But something was missing. Something vital. Momentum. Ferocity. Echo. Jamaica was where the match had been struck. But there was no wind here to fan the flames. Garvey could feel it. His voice, though passionate, reverberated only so far before dissolving into silence. He was living in a volcano of potential, but one that refused to erupt. He needed more than sympathy. He needed critical mass. The realization of limit. The realization did not come all at once. It settled in over months, slowly, like dusk falling over a restless town. He saw it in the half-hearted applause after his most impassioned speeches. He heard it in the reluctance of the upper class, light-skinned professionals and government allies who nodded along with his ideas in private, only to disavow him publicly. He felt it in the British colonial eyes that followed him with growing suspicion, framing his words not as inspiration, but as insubordination. Even some among the black working class hesitated. Generations of indoctrination had left them wary of visions too grand. Some feared reprisals. Others simply could not fathom a different future they had never been taught to. Garvey's dream was massive, and Jamaica, though sacred, was a cage. The search for a platform. In the long, sleepless nights that followed, Garvey poured himself into study. He read every newspaper, devoured every pamphlet, traced the rhythms of movements that had succeeded and failed. He looked to London again, but found it too imperial, too white, too watchful. Then he turned his gaze westward, the United States, more specifically, Harlem. To most in Jamaica, America was a place of contradiction. It was where family members went to send back remittances, but also where black people disappeared in chains, where lynchings made headlines, and segregation split streets like barbed wire. But to Garvey, Harlem wasn't a land of contradiction. It was a crucible. He had read about it, this pocket of Manhattan, where black writers, preachers, merchants, and radicals gathered in cafes and church basements, where newspapers like the Chicago Defender and the New York Age chronicled the lives of black Americans in their own voices. He knew that the U.S. housed more than 11 million black souls, most of them clustered in the South, but millions migrating north, seeking wages, land, and freedom during what historians would call the Great Migration. These were people on the move, searching, building, hungry for meaning. And Marcus Garvey had something to feed them. His speeches in Jamaica were beginning to incorporate this new vision. He spoke not only of Africa, but of Harlem, of Chicago, of the diaspora in motion. And he declared it boldly. The UNIA would go to America. He would take the movement across the sea, not to beg for help, but to plant a flag, to awaken millions. To electrify a people that the world had tried to keep quiet. Departure. The island's quiet goodbye. In March of 1916, Garvey packed his things. The room he had once turned into a command post now felt too small. The air inside it stale from repetition. His notebooks were worn, their pages dog-eared and covered in pencil strokes, so dense they looked like battlefields. He kissed his mother's hand goodbye. She did not ask him to stay. She understood, perhaps more than anyone else. He carried no fortune, only manuscripts, letters of recommendation, the embryonic constitution of the UNIA, and a small stack of editorials he hoped to publish once he arrived. At the dock, a few close followers stood beside him. They held his gaze with something deeper than admiration. It was awe. He was not the tallest man, not the loudest. But when he looked at you, it felt as if your soul had been summoned. He did not just ask for loyalty. He asked you to imagine the impossible and believe it could be real. As the ship pulled away from Kingston Harbor, Garvey stood on the upper deck, eyes fixed on the coastline. He didn't wave. He didn't cry. He watched, stoic, focused, already building the next world in his mind. Arrival, the electric heart of Black America. Harlem, June 1916. It was not what he expected. It was more. The streets buzzed like a beehive, horses and trolleys fighting for space, peddlers shouting, children laughing, couples strolling beneath neon signs and gaslight lanterns. But most striking of all were the faces, black faces, everywhere, not silent, not apologetic, alive. He saw barbershops owned by black men, grocery stores with black women behind the counter, theaters that played jazz into the night, street preachers standing on crates, college students arguing about the latest issues in the crisis, W.E.B. Du Bois' powerful magazine. He heard debates about politics, religion, socialism, Garveyism, even though they didn't yet know his name. But they would, soon. He knew he had landed exactly where he needed to be. Harlem was a storm of culture, consciousness, and friction. And Garvey was lightning. First steps on American soil. He wasted no time. Within weeks, Garvey began giving small lectures in rented church halls and community centers. His accent marked him as foreign, but his passion made him familiar. He spoke of unity across continents, of Africa as not a relic of the past, but a promise for the future. He spoke of economic independence, black businesses owned by black hands. He spoke of returning to Africa, not as beggars or refugees, but as builders. The audiences grew slowly at first, a dozen, then 30, then 70. But more important than numbers was the feeling in the room. People didn't just listen. They leaned in. They believed, confronting the divide. Garvey soon discovered that Black America was far from unified. There were divisions everywhere, by class, by skin tone, by ideology. The educated elite often looked down on Southern migrants. The light-skinned elite considered themselves closer to whiteness. And there were deep rifts between integrationists like Du Bois and more militant nationalists. Garvey positioned himself outside all of them. He was not asking for acceptance into American whiteness. He was calling for black sovereignty, economic separation, racial pride without apology. He began to draw not just followers, but enemies. Critics accused him of demagoguery, of playing on emotion, of being naive, theatrical, too ambitious. They didn't understand. Garvey wasn't just launching an organization. He was declaring a nation. The city begins to roar. By the end of 1916, Garvey had held meetings in Philadelphia, Boston, New Haven, and Washington, D.C. The UNIA chapters began to multiply. Membership grew slowly but steadily, driven by sermons, pamphlets, and word of mouth from people who heard this foreign man speak and felt something ancient stir inside them. Garvey was not offering politics. He was offering identity. In a world that erased blackness, he amplified it. In a system that suppressed African heritage, he exalted it. He began referring to himself publicly as the Provisional President of Africa. And the black world started to take notice. The embers catch fire. Late one night, walking alone through the quiet streets of Harlem, Garvey looked up at the stars above Lenox Avenue. The sky here was darker than Jamaica's, the air colder, but he didn't shiver. He smiled. The wind had changed. The fire had found air. And the world, white, black, and otherwise, was about to hear his name. Chapter 7, Harlem's Roar, 1917 to 1919, The Rise of a Messenger, The Sound of a Movement. There's a kind of noise that cities make when they're about to give birth to something unforgettable. It's not just traffic or footsteps or sirens. It's something more primal, more rhythmic. It's a kind of noise that sounds like hunger and hope and prophecy all tangled into one. Harlem, in the spring of 1917, was humming with that sound. The streets pulsed with newness. Men in pressed coats lined barbershops talking politics. Women in wide-brimmed hats poured into churches, balancing babies on their hips and scripture on their tongues. Jazz filtered from windows. Poets scribbled verses under flickering lamplight. Southern migrants still carried red dirt in their boots and old hymns in their throats, now mixing with Caribbean accents, African philosophies, and Northern agitation. It was not just a neighborhood. Harlem was becoming a capital, an unsanctioned capital of black consciousness, of modernity, of rebellion. And into this living, breathing organism walked a man who spoke with thunder. His name was Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and Harlem, though it did not know it yet, was about to roar his name across the world. A voice in the wilderness becomes a prophet in the storm. When Garvey first arrived, he was seen as curious, a sharply dressed, heavy-set Jamaican with an upright posture and the cadence of a preacher. Some mocked his formality. Others called him eccentric. But those who stopped to listen to his speeches, who caught even a fragment of his sentences, were left altered. He didn't speak in soft hopes. He spoke in declarations. He didn't beg for equality. He promised destiny. He didn't teach history as a wound. He wielded it as a sword. In meeting halls, street corners, rented theaters, and storefront churches, Garvey would rise before the crowd, his chest firm, his chin tilted toward the heavens, and begin to speak. And when he did, something happened to the air. It thickened. It listened. He would pace. Point. Pause with purpose. And then strike again with a line like a hammer. Up, you mighty race. You can accomplish what you will. It wasn't just a sentence. It was a dare. The gathering storm of the UNIA. By the end of 1917, Garvey had reestablished the Universal Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, in New York, now with the world's most densely populated black city as its launch pad. The headquarters were modest at first, rented rooms, borrowed furniture, volunteer staff. But the vision was colossal. He introduced a membership model. He developed uniforms. He drafted codes of conduct. He insisted that his followers dress with elegance and carry themselves with regal dignity. He was not building a club. He was birthing a nation without borders. And the people came. They came from all walks of life. Pullman porters, fresh off long train rides. Southern migrants, still carrying the ache of cotton fields in their hands. Caribbean women, who had lost sons to shipyards and fathers to false promises. African students, who burned with dreams of returning home to lead revolutions. Children who had never heard their skin called beautiful in a sentence that wasn't followed by apology. The movement grew by the hundreds, then the thousands. Then tens of thousands. The Negro World, a paper with a pulse. In 1918, Garvey launched the Negro World, the newspaper that would become the artery of the movement. Printed weekly and distributed across continents, the Negro World was more than a publication. It was a weapon of mass instruction. Written by and for black minds, it covered global news, published essays on African history, showcased poetry, art, and radical thought. Included translations in Spanish and French, reaching black communities in Latin America, Africa, and the Caribbean. Colonial authorities from Nigeria to Trinidad tried to ban it, but they couldn't stop the message from spreading. Children smuggled copies under floorboards. Dock workers passed it hand to hand in coastal bars. Market women read it aloud during breaks, voices rising with each sentence. It gave black people a new kind of mirror, one that didn't distort, but revealed. Speeches that made the earth tremble. Garvey's public addresses began drawing crowds that rivaled sermons and rivaled protests. He often spoke in the open air on 135th Street at Liberty Hall in small towns across the Northeast. At times, thousands would gather to hear him. And when they did not come for entertainment. They came for resurrection. In one famous address, Garvey stepped up to the podium in full military-style uniform, the gold braids catching the sun, and delivered what many would call one of the most rousing speeches of the 20th century. He told them of an Africa rising, its cities rebuilt, its army strong, its leaders chosen by and for the people. He painted a picture of ships with black captains sailing between Africa and the Americas, trading goods and ideas. He described schools where African children would learn of their ancestors as mathematicians, astronomers, kings and queens, not slaves. And then he paused. He looked out into the crowd, his gaze like a command. "We shall not apologize for being black. We shall not apologize for being African. We shall build. We shall return. We shall rise." The crowd erupted. Grown men wept. Teenagers clenched fists. Women clutched their hearts, hearing something they'd never been told and somehow always known. Enemies gather in the shadows. But with greatness came threat, and the empire began to take notice. To white supremacists, Garvey was dangerous not because he was violent, but because he was effective. He wasn't asking white America for anything. He was telling black America that they didn't need them. The idea that black people could live without white approval, that they could create their own banks, own their own businesses, publish their own newspapers, build their own ships, terrified the establishment. Federal agents began attending UNIA meetings in disguise. The Bureau of Investigation, led by a young J. Edgar Hoover, began compiling a file on Garvey. They labeled him a radical, a demagogue, a Negro agitator. Hoover, in a now infamous memo, referred to Garvey as a notorious Negro agitator, unquestionably the most prominent Negro in America. He wasn't wrong. Garvey was everywhere, and he was only getting louder. The parade that changed the world. In August 1918, Garvey organized the first massive UNIA parade through Harlem, a spectacle never before seen in black America. Thousands marched in uniformed ranks, men in military-style dress, women in white robes and feathered hats, children in school uniforms. Banners flew with slogans like, "Africa for the Africans, at home and abroad," "Be black, buy black, think black, and all else will take care of itself." Marching bands played anthems written by Garvey himself. At the head of the procession, Garvey stood atop a carriage, saluting the crowd, eyes fixed on the horizon, as if seeing a future no one else had yet dared imagine. Spectators lined the sidewalks 10 deep. White journalists mocked it, called it theater, called it a farce. But black people, they called it a beginning, a declaration, a visual prophecy that they were, in fact, a people. Not a color, not a caste, a nation. The man becomes a myth. By the end of 1919, Garvey was no longer just a speaker. He was a symbol, a face painted on walls in Kingston, Dakar, Port-au-Prince, and London. A name whispered in prisons and shouted in marches. The man from St. Anne's Bay, who once spoke to empty rooms in Jamaica, was now reaching millions. And he was just getting started. One night, standing beneath a Harlem street lamp, Garvey turned to one of his close aides and said quietly, "This is not the end. This is the trumpet. The war has not yet begun." And he was right, because in the next chapter, the movement would not just speak. It would sail. Chapter 8, The Rise of a Black Empire, 1919 to 1921, Dreams Forged in Iron, A Nation Built Without Borders. Empires are not always born with borders. Some are born in the space between hope and hunger, in the silence after centuries of erasure. They are imagined first in whispers, then in slogans, then in the thunder of marching feet and the ink of declarations that dare to claim the impossible. Marcus Mosiah Garvey had always known that the world would never give black people power willingly. So he decided they would build their own, not as tenants, not as shadows in someone else's history, but as architects of a sovereign destiny. By 1919, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, had evolved from a bold idea into the most powerful, organized, and audacious black movement the world had ever seen. What had begun in the back rooms of Kingston and the rented halls of Harlem had now grown into a sprawling international force. The black masses were awakening, and they were marching beneath one flag, the infrastructure of liberation. The UNIA was no longer just a slogan. It was an institution with departments, policies, uniforms, rituals, and codes. At its headquarters in Harlem's Liberty Hall, clerks typed membership forms day and night. The walls were draped in red, black, and green, colors that would later become the Pan-African flag. Red for the blood, black for the people, green for the land. Garvey chose these colors deliberately. They weren't just decorative. They were theological. They declared that blackness was not a problem to be solved, but a people to be honored. By 1920, the UNIA had over 1,000 chapters in more than 40 countries, with members across the Caribbean, Central and South America, West Africa, Canada, and the United States. Tens of thousands swore oaths of allegiance to the cause. Local chapters raised funds, ran businesses, organized lectures, and published pamphlets in multiple languages. There were UNIA schools, UNIA cooperatives, UNIA restaurants, and at the center of it all stood Garvey, regal in his military-style regalia, crowned with gold braid, epaulets on his shoulders, and medals that gleamed beneath stage lights. To some, he looked absurd. To others, he looked like the king the African race had been waiting for. The dream of the Black Star Line. Garvey knew symbols were not enough. He needed steel. He needed ships. He had seen too many revolutions die in the space between vision and infrastructure. He understood that a true nation, whether on land or in diaspora, required commerce, trade, ownership, autonomy over movement. And so, in 1919, he founded the Black Star Line Steamship Corporation, the economic crown jewel of the UNIA's vision. The idea was revolutionary. A black-owned, black-operated fleet of ships that would connect people of African descent around the world. Goods would be traded from the United States to the Caribbean, from South America to Africa. Resources would flow not through colonial hands, but through the hands of a unified black economy. The name Black Star was chosen deliberately as a direct response to the British White Star Line, which had operated the Titanic. Garvey's line would not carry aristocrats. It would carry redemption. He raised capital from the community, selling $5 shares to black investors across the UNIA network. He urged people from every walk of life to contribute: factory workers, teachers, hairdressers, farmers, veterans. Every man and woman of a race, he declared, must put their dollar toward the building of our commercial empire. It was not just an investment in ships. It was an investment in themselves. Steel hulls and soaring spirits. In September of 1919, the UNIA purchased its first ship, the SS Yarmouth, an aging steamer that had seen better days. It was rechristened the SS Frederick Douglass in honor of the great abolitionist. Garvey toured the ship before its maiden voyage, placing his hand on its rusting hull and calling it the first vessel of many. It didn't matter that the ship was imperfect. What mattered was that it existed and that it was theirs. The symbolism was electric. Crowds gathered on the piers. Children waved flags. Preachers blessed the journey. When the Frederick Douglass departed New York Harbor for the Caribbean, carrying rum, canned goods, and pride, it was as if the entire African diaspora was sailing with it. Soon after, more ships were acquired. The SS Shadyside. The SS Antonio Maceo, named for the Cuban revolutionary. Each one greeted like a gospel ship, part commerce, part prophecy. But behind the celebration, trouble brewed. The cracks beneath the gold. Garvey was a visionary, but not a businessman. The Black Star Line was rushed into operation with minimal maritime expertise. The ships, purchased at inflated prices, often required extensive repairs. Corruption crept in. Some of the men Garvey trusted were more interested in personal gain than liberation. Mismanagement led to shipping delays, cargo spoilage, and lawsuits. White-owned newspapers mocked the endeavor. Government agents watched closely. And within his own movement, dissent grew. Some believed Garvey's increasingly regal persona, complete with robes, thrones, and coronation language, was becoming a distraction. Others believed he was spreading himself too thin, trying to build a nation without the trained infrastructure to support it. But Garvey pressed forward, always forward. Even as ships broke down, he told his followers they would one day build their own shipyards. Even as investors grew anxious, he reminded them that freedom required sacrifice. Even as rumors of sabotage swirled, he remained steadfast. "We are going to build the greatest black nation that has ever existed, not with the permission of the white man, but in spite of him." The International Convention of 1920. In August of 1920, Garvey summoned delegates from around the world to Harlem for what he declared the first international convention of the Negro peoples of the world. It was a spectacle. Tens of thousands of UNIA members flooded New York. Parades stretched for blocks. Marching bands played anthems composed by Garvey himself. Uniformed divisions of men, women, and children marched beneath banners bearing the Pan-African flag. At Liberty Hall, delegates from Africa, the Caribbean, Canada, and the U.S. gathered to draft the Declaration of the Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World, a searing indictment of racism, and a declaration of sovereignty, pride, and international unity. Garvey was introduced on stage as His Excellency, the Provisional President of Africa. And for the first time in front of the world, he publicly assumed the mantle he had been growing into for years. He gave a thunderous speech beneath the blazing lights, the audience rising again and again in ovation. He spoke of the new Negro, unchained and unapologetic. He spoke of Africa, not as a dream, but as a future. He declared, "We are going to Africa to build a government of our own, a nation where black men shall rule themselves and no longer be the footstool of others." That night, Harlem did not sleep. The drums of a rising empire echoed deep into the early hours. From movement to myth, the world watched in awe and fear. Garvey was now the most recognized black leader on earth. His speeches were reprinted from Nigeria to Haiti. His face appeared in posters and newspaper clippings across continents. His message translated into French, Spanish, Yoruba, Chui, and Arabic. Children in Trinidad memorized his slogans. Fishermen in Sierra Leone wore UNIA pins on their hats. Porters in Chicago saved half their paychecks to send donations to Liberty Hall. And across the South, black men and women still living under Jim Crow began to whisper of Garvey as if he were a prophet, a Moses, a redeemer who would lead them out of the wilderness. But all empires cast long shadows. What Garvey built was stunning, but it was not invulnerable. The same systems he sought to overthrow had begun to move against him. Whispers became investigations. Allies became informants. Enemies, seen and unseen, were circling. But for now, in 1920, the Black Star line still stood. The red, black, and green still flew. And Garvey, flawed, brilliant, obsessed, stood at the helm of the largest black movement in modern history. He had not just dreamed of an empire. He had begun to build it, and the world would never be the same.